Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Scientific experts have warned that deadly pandemics are likely to keep happening if action is not taken to protect natural environments. Future pandemics will happen more often, spread faster, and kill more people than COVID-19, the experts said. Such events are also expected to cause lasting harm to the world economy. The warning came in a report from the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, an international expert group that advises governments. The group has more than 130 member states. The experts called for major efforts aimed at preventing pandemics rather than trying to contain them after they happen. The report urges major worldwide efforts to stop habitat destruction that can lead viruses to jump from wild animals to humans. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has estimated that 3 out of every 4 new or emerging infectious diseases in people come from animals. Scientists have said COVID-19 probably started in bats and began spreading among humans at a market in China. In their report, the experts predict that about half of an estimated 1.7 million undiscovered viruses in nature might be able to infect people. Activities such as poaching or clearing forests to grow soy or palm oil can bring humans and disease closer together. Deforestation, agriculture expansion, urbanization, and other land use changes are responsible for about 1/3 of all new diseases that have emerged since 1960, the report says. The $100 billion global wildlife trade is also responsible for the spread of new and existing diseases. The experts predict that about $50 billion a year in pandemic prevention spending could save the world about $1 trillion a year on average in economic damage. They said that as of July, the economic cost from COVID-19 was at least $8 trillion and rising. Peter Daszak was the report's lead writer. He is president of EcoHealth Alliance, an international health, environment, and development organization. He said in a statement that even though the experts call for urgent action, this is not a doom and gloom report saying the world's going to end and it's too late. Instead, Daszak said it should be seen as an optimistic call for action. He noted that the current method for dealing with pandemics is to wait for them to emerge and then try to identify them before they spread. COVID-19 has demonstrated the problems with that plan. Chinese officials attempted to contain COVID-19 after the disease was discovered last year, but it was already too late. And here we are, waiting for a vaccine and drugs to work, Daszak said. It's not a good strategy. We need to do more. I'm Brian Lynn.
Nation of Singapore, several average people working in offices or driving taxis claim to be of royal blood. They say they are descendants of a 19th century ruler who gave up the island to the British. But few members of Singapore's cities know about their true royal past. This is difficult for Tengku, or Prince Shawal. He is considered by some members of his family as the leader of the House of Singapore. They still exist, is the answer the 51-year-old says he often receives when he tells people he is one of the descendants of Sultan Hussein Shah. Hussein Shah signed treaties with Britain that led to colonial rule. Singapore became an independent city-state in 1965. Shawal is one of several Singaporeans who have the royal name Tengku. It means prince or princess in Malay. They claim links to the Sultan. Until about 20 years ago, possibly 14 of them still lived in their ancestral home, a crowded and damaged palace. They were removed from the home by the government, which turned it into a museum. At the time, the government said about 79 descendants were offered money as part of a colonial period agreement to provide for the Sultan's family. Many of the others were living in other countries, it said. The descendants' names were not made public, making it difficult to know who really is royalty. The government told Reuters that all but one of the payments have been made. Shawal showed Reuters letters from the government that identified him as a descendant. He said he often visits the palace that was turned into a museum. He faces personal problems because of the coronavirus pandemic. But, Shawal said, he tries to keep the Sultan's history alive by wearing traditional royal clothing and attending celebrations. Other descendants warn about the dangers of living in the past or are too busy with their normal lives. We are not a dynasty. It is not important whether you are a descendant of the royal family or not, said Tengku Indra. Now 67, he lived in the palace as a child. Indra was described as the great-great-great-great-grandson of Sultan Hussein in an article by the government organization Friends of the Museums Singapore last year. Indra's son is a 40-year-old businessman, Tunku Azan. He has a 2-year-old daughter who would be one of the youngest descendants. He thinks future generations will not take much interest in the Sultan's history. The past remains uncherished, he said. I'm Susan Shand.
Since the beginning of the coronavirus crisis, many people have had to change their habits or usual ways of doing things. Some people who used to go to school now study at home. Some of them have been trying to get in the habit of learning and studying on their own. How might habits connect with studying and learning? Today's education tips will explore that very question. Habits are regular ways of dealing with your environment. You generally do not pay attention to them. In the book Good Habits, Bad Habits, Dr. Wendy Wood notes that a habit turns the world around you, your context, into a trigger to act. Habits take many forms, eating, exercising, even studying. You may not realize it, but habits make up many of the actions that you do every day. In the book Atomic Habits, James Clear describes a 4-step process by which habits are made. These steps are cue, craving, response, and reward. The cue tells your brain to begin a behavior. The craving is what makes you want to do something. The response is the actual habit that you perform. The response, in turn, gives you a reward. Rewards are the end goal of every habit, Clear writes. Consider this example. Maybe you have the habit of often checking social media. The cue might be a feeling of boredom while you are near your computer or phone. The craving could be a desire to stop that feeling. The response is checking social media, and the reward is seeing something interesting. When that process is repeated many times, it becomes a habit. Clear believes that to create a good habit, you need to follow several steps. You need to make your new habit obvious, or easy to see or understand. The habit should also be attractive, simple, and satisfying. Let's think about how you might develop an English study habit. You should organize your surroundings in such a way that the cues of your new habit are very obvious. For example, if you want to get in the habit of studying English every day, leave English books or notes in a very clear place. To make your habit attractive, Clear recommends joining a culture where your new desired behavior is the normal behavior. For example, you could join a group of other English learners in online meetings. To make your new habit easy, you could decrease the number of steps you have to take in order to study. You could also try reducing the amount of time you study. Clear suggests beginning your habits with limited, shorter time periods, 2 minutes, for example. As you repeat the practice over time, you can go longer. An important point to keep in mind is that if you place too many demands on yourself, you are more likely to give up on your new habit. Finally, you need to make your habit satisfying. You can give yourself a reward after completing your new habit. For example, if you study English for 15 minutes, you could reward yourself by listening to a song you like. Or you could think about how much progress you have made since you first started studying English. Wood notes that your reward should come right after you do your new habit. Rewards have to be experienced right after we do something in order to build habit associations in memory, she writes. Building new habits can take time. You may have to repeat an action many times before it becomes a habit. But with time, careful planning, and continued practice, you can do it. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Just before sunrise on April 12, 1861, the first shot was fired in the American Civil War. A heavy mortar roared, sending a shell high over the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina. The shell dropped and exploded above Fort Sumter, a United States military base on an island in the harbor. The explosion was a signal for all Confederate guns surrounding the fort to open fire. Shell after shell smashed into the fort. The booming of the cannons woke the people of Charleston. They rushed to the harbor and cheered as the bursting shells lighted the dark sky. Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer tell about the attack on Fort Sumter.
Confederate leaders ordered the attack after President Abraham Lincoln refused to withdraw the small force of American soldiers at Sumter. Food supplies at the fort were very low, and Southerners expected hunger would force the soldiers to leave. But Lincoln announced he was sending a ship to Fort Sumter with food. Confederate President Jefferson Davis ordered his commander in Charleston, General Beauregard, to destroy the fort before the food could arrive.
The attack started from Fort Johnson, across the harbor from Sumter. A Virginia congressman, Roger Pryor, was visiting Fort Johnson when the order to fire was given. The fort's commander asked Pryor if he would like the honor of firing the mortar that would begin the attack. "No," answered Pryor, and his voice shook. "I cannot fire the first gun of the war." But others could, and the attack began.
At Fort Sumter, Major Robert Anderson and his men waited 3 hours before firing back at the Confederate guns. Anderson could not use his most powerful cannons. They were in the open, at the top of the fort, where there was no protection for the gunners. Too many of his small force would be lost if he tried to fire these guns. So Anderson had his men fire the smaller cannon from better protected positions. These, however, did not do much damage to the Confederate guns.
The shelling continued all day. A big cloud of smoke rose high in the air over Fort Sumter. The smoke was seen by United States Navy ships a few miles outside Charleston Harbor. They had come with the ship bringing food for the men at Sumter. There were soldiers on these ships, but they could not reach the fort to help Major Anderson. Confederate boats blocked the entrance to the harbor, and Confederate guns could destroy any ship that tried to enter. The commander of the naval force, Captain Fox, had hoped to move the soldiers to Sumter in small boats, but the sea was so rough that the small boats could not be used. Fox could only watch and hope for calmer seas.
Confederate shells continued to smash into Sumter throughout the night and into the morning of the second day. The fires at Fort Sumter burned higher, and smoke filled the rooms where soldiers still tried to fire their cannons. About noon, three men arrived at the fort in a small boat. One of them was Lewis Wigfall, a former United States senator from Texas, now a Confederate officer. He asked to see Major Anderson. "I come from General Beauregard," he said. "It is time to put a stop to this, sir. The flames are raging all around you, and you have defended your flag bravely. Will you leave, sir?" Wigfall asked.
Major Anderson was ready to stop fighting. His men had done all that could be expected of them. They had fought well against a much stronger enemy. Anderson said he would surrender if he and his men could leave with honor. Wigfall agreed. He told Anderson to lower his flag and the firing would stop. Down came the United States flag, and up went the white flag of surrender. The battle of Fort Sumter was over. More than 4,000 shells had been fired during the 33 hours of fighting, but no one on either side was killed. One United States soldier, however, was killed the next day when a cannon exploded as Anderson's men prepared to leave the fort.
The news of Anderson's surrender reached Washington late Saturday, April 13th. President Lincoln and his cabinet met the next day and wrote a declaration that the president would announce on Monday. In it, Lincoln said powerful forces had seized control in 7 states of the South. He said these forces were too strong to be stopped by courts or policemen. Lincoln said troops were needed. He requested that the states send him 75,000 soldiers. He said these men would be used to get control of forts and other federal property seized from the Union.
Lincoln knew he had the support of his own party. He also wanted Northern Democrats to give him full support. So, Sunday evening, a Republican congressman visited the top Democrat of the North, Senator Stephen Douglas. The congressman urged Douglas to go to the White House and tell Lincoln that he would do all he could to help put down the rebellion in the South. At first, Douglas refused. He said Lincoln had removed Democrats, friends of his, from government jobs, and had given the jobs to Republicans. Douglas said he didn't like this. Anyway, he said, Lincoln probably did not want his advice. The congressman, George Ashman, urged Douglas to forget party politics. He said Lincoln and the country needed the senator's help. Douglas finally agreed to talk with Lincoln. He and Ashman went immediately to the White House.
Lincoln welcomed his old political opponent. He explained his plans and read to Douglas the declaration he would announce the next day. Douglas said he agreed with every word of it, except, he said, 75,000 soldiers would not be enough. Remembering his problems with Southern extremists, he urged Lincoln to ask for 200,000 men. He told the president, "You do not know the dishonest purposes of those men as well as I do." Lincoln and Douglas talked for 2 hours. Then the senator gave a statement for the newspapers. He said he still opposed the administration on political questions, but, he said, he completely supported Lincoln's efforts to protect the Union. Douglas was to live for only a few more months. He spent this time working for the Union. He traveled through the states of the Northwest, making many speeches. Douglas urged Democrats everywhere to support the Republican government. He told them, "There can be no neutrals in this war, only patriots or traitors."
Throughout the North, thousands of men rushed to answer Lincoln's call for troops. Within 2 days, a military group from Boston left for Washington. Other groups formed quickly in northern cities and began training for war. Lincoln received a different answer, however, from the border states between North and South. Virginia's governor said he would not send troops to help the North get control of the South. North Carolina's governor said the request violated the Constitution. He would have no part of it. Tennessee said it would not send one man to help force Southern states back into the Union. But it said it would send 50,000 troops to defend Southern rights. Lincoln got the same answer from the governors of Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. For several days, it seemed that all these states would secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
Lincoln worried most about Virginia, the powerful state just across the Potomac River from Washington. A secession convention already was meeting at the state capital. On April 17th, the convention voted to take Virginia out of the Union. Virginia's vote to secede forced an American Army officer to make a most difficult decision. The officer was Colonel Robert E. Lee, a citizen of Virginia. The Army's top commander, General Winfield Scott, had called Lee to Washington. Scott believed Lee was the best officer in the Army. Lincoln agreed. He asked Lee to take General Scott's job to become the Army chief. Lee was offered the job on the same day that Virginia left the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.